form a slice authority that's responsible for the management of the slice and for the experiments, and also can delegate certain functions, functions to PIs to assign researchers, to researchers to do experiments, and so on and so forth. What this does is it simplifies the world. I have somebody who provides resources, somebody that utilizes them, and two main actors that are responsible. We may get people to agree to that. Finally, we definitely have actors. We have opt-in and third-party users. That's another part of this, off to the side. And there is a set of necessary agreements that certainly include resource usage, maybe cooperative operations agreements, and definitely agreements on things like acceptable use, various best practices, and so on and so forth. If you don't have these things somehow among these actors, you're not going to be able to do anything, I think. I'm going to come back to this for a whole talk, so I don't want to... And so that's in that structure document. Okay. Opt-in users are those who participate or opt into a Genie experiment and become part of the slice. They may choose to opt in. They may get pulled in if their traffic is pulled into Genie. Or in a somewhat reversal of things, you can say we have third-party users outside the Genie suite, but they may be undesirably affected by a Genie experiment. So these are the unintended opt-in folks. Your server is pinged by a Genie experiment. Your phone is rung in the middle of the night. All of those things have happened in different cases, and it has to be mitigated.
Question?
Yeah.
So I'm sort of brought in here by somebody else, and because I haven't been part of this group, it's not great, but it seems to me that this line you're drawing is sort of the official Genie line of what an act it is, but from my perspective as building a fairly large bit of infrastructure, the definition of the user could be in about six different ways. Maybe that's all I'll bring up later.
So that would be a good thing to bring.
All of which I would be concerned about in different ways.
Okay. So if we can add to this list, good.
And I guess I would add to that, all of those are correct, depending on the experiment. Or each of them is correct for some.
Well, for me, a user may be a new node, because I'll have an open interface to say, all you have to do this to participate is do this. They're providing infrastructure, which a user in that sense would use, but a user in that sense might be Seattle, which has other users which may have impact on them.
So please bring it up when you get here. There's lots of things that can overlap. There's lots of things that can be recursive. Lots of...
Okay.
The main issue here is not so much as to exactly what they do and what happens, because that will have a million different ways of doing it. It's not clear that classifying that is necessary. What is the case, or to see the common characteristic, is that these are not experimenters themselves. So these are not people trying out things themselves. These are parties that, to different extents, are to different amounts of distance, are divorced from a normal research user. So this could be Glenma, on one extreme, in a sense, they found a cool web service, and it just happens to be a Genie web service. Or it could be somebody like an undergraduate student at the university who is taking your class, and you say, all right.
But I'm just as worried, if not more, the person who isn't a user in that sense and is running an experiment.
I mean, worried in the sense, for once, that we worry about two things. We want to make it possible to attract those users, because that's what we need in some experiments. And secondly, however, we also want to protect those users, because unlike graduate PhD students who can evaluate, should be able to evaluate the scholar.
Graduate student scan.
Right, at least they're professionals.
Yes.
At least budding ones. They have a degree in computer science or whatever. But in any event, they are the ones which don't have that characteristics may not have the ability to judge as to whether this experiment is appropriate for the needs and situation.
Yeah. I want us to move on here, so we don't, because we're otherwise we'll never get done today. But please bring things up when you can. We listed various opt-in goals. These are dear to the heart of Genie. adding realism to experiments, facilitating key experiments, i.e. host an ISP in a slice so you can check the traffic. It's opt-in kind of stuff is certainly essential to doing full-scale, long-running experiments, which people want to do in Genie. A lot of reasons why you want to do opt-in. The opt-in use cases, and for each of these, we have in the document a description, a good piece on implementations that we're aware of, and finally the issues associated with each use case, of which there are significant issues. Use case one, user chooses to participate. Use case two, user chooses to participate and contribute resources, right? Three, group of users are pulled into a Genie experiment, and four, it's the third party use is undesirably affected. So Justin's Seattle project is a very nice example of the participating to contribute resources. I think that what Guido's going to talk about is the possibility of pulling users into an experiment. So it's probably in use case three here that things show up, perhaps. Or maybe they choose to do something to get a service, and that's use case one. Okay.
I think Stanford won't let us just opt in anybody.
Well, so one of the things that we've said about use case three, just to say it short circuit, is you may pull users in, but give them the ability to opt out. Okay, that's one of the techniques that might be dealt with. Yeah.
So you feel that the users of our system should be choosing which researcher to run code on?
No, I don't think so. I think Seattle is the. So, by the way, there's all sorts of. There's going to be a line of lawyers eventually, right? But the issue is, what's the experiment? It's Seattle.
And it may well be distinctions in the sense. In some experiments, you may provide finite weight opt-in, in a sense. I'll provide resources, but only to people whose last name starts with C. That's reasonable.
Matt, did you want to? Okay. Okay. And finally, the third party user who's undesirably affected. So Larry Peterson produced a lot of good information, brought stuff to the meeting in April. They've had years of experience with this in Planet Lab, and they have mechanisms for dealing with it. They've had big things, little things, all sorts of things. It's a big deal. But they bring a lot of experience. Here's that famous Genie slide of projects and the projects that are involved in opt-in one way or the other. I'm not going to dwell on this. The opt-in mechanisms that we discussed are, you know, users may choose, they may point a browser, load software, their traffic might get hijacked, lots of possibilities. There are connectivity options, certainly via the internet, via some sort of native Genie network. Lots of different layers are possible. And definitely there are internet gateways underway in Genie to bring traffic in and deal with it and so forth. And again, Matt's writing requirements for that. People are building it. Lots of stuff's happening. Okay. Opt-in risks to entities and actors. There's a lot of the possible risks. This is just a very quick list. So aggregates. Somebody may gather too many resources and swamp an aggregate. They may disrupt other slivers in an aggregate. Bad things can happen. You have risks to opt-in users themselves. Loss of privacy is a huge issue. Loss of service, you know, if they're co-opted and then things break, is a big issue. They may get a virus if they've contributed a node. There's lots of risks there. And these risks obviously mean if bad things happen after I've opted into a Genie experiment, I'll never do it again, right? So that's possible. And the risks to the third-party users are all these kinds of disruptions and stuff. People get very mad.
You seem to be completely missing the legal liability things. The first thing everybody says
that's in the privacy kind of thing, yeah.
That's a risk.
Can you defer it? Because I'll be talking about that.
Okay, I'm just saying, whatever high level this is, that is the first thing I get asked after all of those.
But yeah. It probably should be on this list as a high level item. But so, one way to begin to discuss these things is to agreements and best practices among which actors. And to have a set of actors and so forth, you have to have a structure. So the simplest thing to assume and the most straightforward thing to assume, which is actually what people have been doing, but you got to say it, is a single suite, a single genie thing with a suite authority at the top. Pick whatever name you wish. And the suite authority has agreements with all of the management and site authorities that are associated with the suite. So, for example, all of these actors agree on an acceptable use policy. All the management authorities, for example, agree to follow a resource usage policy that makes resources available, perhaps to all slice authorities, all slices, in the Genie suite, but maybe with some exceptions. Now, folks, this is exactly the kind of thing that Planet Lab does. But if we assume it and talk about it, we can add to it. All the actors probably agree on some sort of cooperative operations policies, and as I said, they all agree on some sort of common best practices, which may include all sorts of opt-in related things. My experiment is not going to disturb others. My experiment is not going to compromise privacy. I'm going to protect data, lots and lots of things. And again, this particular piece is in the structure document. And finally, we have a list of best practices for mitigating risks and solving issues. So this is the current structure in the document. I think Hennig's talk is organized somewhat differently. But you're going to want to have people to agree on how I plan an experiment, what I do and don't do, how you set up and run an experiment. It's very critical about how you enroll opt-in users. So if you give them a choice, you have to give them an informed choice. If you give them an opt-out, you have to give them an informed opt-out, and all sorts of things. And there are extraordinarily important legal issues with gathering and storing experimental data. There are privacy issues and so on. And there are people that have been, and we have contributions where people have been revealing data about a network, but it's very limited data. And there's lots of issues about you'd like to protect anonymity, but you know if you try to just scramble it, it doesn't always work, and tons of issues that way. And finally, the disruption issue, which the Planet Lab folks have the most experience with. So that's going to be discussed in Hennig's talk. So here we come back to the outline. This, we suggest, is the A to Z view of opt-in. What we'd really like to do is get this document reviewed now and then decide what other things need we fill in and where do we go from here. Of course, we'd love to have people willing to help. So we'll man the door before you leave and see who can. Are there any questions here? I don't. Okay. Which gets us back to the next talk, which I believe. Yep, it's Guido.
I actually have to go to the airport 20 minutes, so.
So perfect timing.
We should all have you stopped.
Perfect.
Oh, yes, sir. Get recorded, Guido.
Careful what he said.
Is there any particular resolution we need for the screen? Oh, that works. Okay, perfect. Right. I'll start with a disclaimer here, actually. I haven't been to these working group meetings before, so if a lot of the wording and it doesn't sound like quite like the rest of the meeting, please forgive me. So I'm from Stanford University. We're building there something called Enterprise Genie, which is an OpenFlow substrate built on a technology called OpenFlow. And we're currently in our group wrestling with opt-in. And I guess from our perspective, you know, at least right now, probably the biggest challenge with opt-in actually has not been proven to be acceptance by system administrators or the university as a whole, but simply has been technical implementation of that, because sort of how to do it at scale in a system turns out, for us at least, to be fairly hard. So who in the room here knows OpenFlow, how OpenFlow works? Okay, so I think what I'm going to do is basically do a fast forward through OpenFlow, so you have a rough idea of how it works and how we're using it to virtualize our system. Because without it, it's probably fairly hard to understand why we're doing so, where our implementation challenges come from, and where also our basic mechanisms for opt-in come from. So, talking about OpenFlow, if today you look at an Ethernet switch or you know, a router for that matter, it's typically a closed platform. If you want to do something really innovative with it, you can't, right? You want to download your own code on it. If you buy something from Cisco, it's typically not possible. If you look inside such a switch, it basically has two major components. There's the data path, which is the switching chipsets that forward packets at high speeds, and there's the control path, the software that sort of makes the high-level routing decisions. So this technology called OpenFlow that we have is basically a new feature that is added to a switch, so basically it just gets added to the operating system of the switch, typically by the switch operator, and that then allows an external controller to basically control how the switch or router behaves. So this OpenFlow controller is just running on a normal PC, running open source, a piece of open source software. So what this allows you is basically to now control all the high-level control functions of your router or switch in a very fine, with a very fine granularity, and allows it to really do innovative things in your network, which for researchers is great. The protocol between the controller and the switch is the OpenFlow protocol. And the basic primitive of the OpenFlow protocol is a flow table entry. And it turns out this primitive is also what's implemented in most of today's switching and routing chips. And the basic idea for flow table entry is that it has a rule, and the rule is basically just a pattern match on the first couple of bits of a packet. So if you get a currently we have, actually we have 11 fields, there's one missing here, but we have the switch port, so there's a physical port where something came in, the MAC source, MAC destination, Ethernet, VLAN, IP source, IP destination, IP protocol, TCP source port, destination port. So basically, if in an open flow network you want to forward packets, you can specify, here are my criteria for a packet. Any of these you can wildcard. I can say I don't care about the source IP address, but I do care about the MAC source address. And then you can define an action for all packets that match the specification. The reason why I'm telling you all of this is that this is sort of the underlying technology that we use in order to manage the network at Stanford that we're then offering as a substrate in which we want to have users opt in. So the actions are sort of a fairly short list. We can either send out the packet on a different port, you can encapsulate it, you can drop the packet, you can send it to a normal processing pipeline. It's actually a few more things. You can rewrite MAC address or IP addresses and things like that. And then we have statistics, so we can count how many packets actually flow through. So let me give you a very short example of how this works in practice. So here, for example, is an OpenFlow switch, and it's connected to a controller. And the controller, in this case, is a routing table and knows that it should make the switch act as a router. So we have a first host sending a packet to the OpenFlow switch. At this point, the OpenFlow switch has no idea what to do with the packet. Right? Initially, it's uninitialized. There's no default setting. So what it'll do, it'll take the packet, send it up to the controller, and basically ask the controller, which is your software, what should I do with this packet? The controller can then look at the packet, consult its routing table, and say, OK, these kind of packets, this is from host 1, 2, 3, 4, should really go to host 5, 6, 7, 8. So what it does is it pushes down a flow entry, like the one we discussed before, that basically says all the packets from 1, 2, 3, 4, and 2, 5, 6, 7, 8 send out on port number 1, because that's where my host is connected. And now the packet is sent back from the controller and can be delivered to the switch. Now, this clearly takes a while. I mean, a while in networking terms. We're talking, you know, a couple of milliseconds, because you have to go all the way up to the controller, have to look at it in software, and go down again. But this only happens for the first packet. Subsequent packets basically get forwarded by the hardware at line rate. So basically, once we've set up a flow, an OpenFlow switch will forward packets at, you know, 10 gigabits or whatever the bandwidth of the switch is. So at Stanford, we basically have a network of 23 switches in our building that runs OpenFlow, and that we can control with our controllers. And basically, the idea is to make these controllers available to experimenters to run experiments on them. And so one more nice thing you can do with OpenFlow is it allows you to virtualize your network. So each of these switches that we have in Gates Building, these are HP Procore 5500 switches, where basically HP added OpenFlow to the switch. So we, just as a background, we have at this point five or six switch vendors that have added OpenFlow to their switching software, including HP, Cisco, Juniper, NEC, Arista, and a few others. So basically, we have these HP switches running at the Gates building, and they come with a normal like packet forwarding software. And for currently, you know, before we came along, these switches were basically just using the normal HP forwarding software in order to forward packets. And our system administrator would configure them to form a spanning tree, and so they would be managed like a normal network component. Now, once this OpenFlow feature is added to the switch, you can now decide per VLAN whether packets on a certain VLAN should either be forwarded by the normal layer 2, layer 3 processing from HP, or via the OpenFlow part that is controlled with a remote controller. So basically, by moving a user to a different VLAN, we can move him from a production environment to an OpenFlow environment where we have now complete control over the traffic. This is sort of our basic mechanism how we can hijack traffic from a user and make it accessible to an external experimenter in terms of forwarding decisions. There's one more twist here, which is, in addition to this virtualization that happens on the switch, where we can basically per VLAN decide whether production, when something switched by production software, when something switched by OpenFlow, we also have basically an external virtualization proxy called a FlowVisor. So what a FlowVisor does is that it has typically a bunch of switches connect to it, and then it'll take each of these switches and virtualize it into multiple switches, and then basically re-offer them to control as above. So in this case, we have three experimenters. The first is Aaron. The second is Heidi. The third is Craig. And they're all running their own controllers that make their own forwarding decisions in the network. And what this FlowVisor does is it takes one of these switches, basically virtualizes three ways. So each of these things, they're running alone on the switch, but at the same time making sure that they can't step onto each other's feet. So basically the routing decisions that each of them are trying to make are separated. Does that make sense to everybody so far? I know this is very, very fast, but yes.
Is there a strong configuration in the hypervisor, or is it just guaranteed exclusion?
I'm sorry, what was it? Is it what configuration?
Is the hypervisor strongly configured that these controllers control these ports, or is it just guaranteed that they don't collide?
It has a policy that gets sort of changed in real time by the aggregate manager. And basically, it provides, at any given time, a guarantee that they can't step on top of each other, but sort of what exactly the policy is actually very complex because it may change in real time. There might be initially overlapping definitions that then at a per flow basis are kept separate.
The policy is completely deduced by the request for the controllers.
Yes, correct. It's done dynamically. There's nothing sort of preloaded or so. Basically, you look at each incoming new flow that's been. So we're doing per flow routing, so each new flow basically generates a new entry in the switches. So for each flow, we decide who gets to control this flow. Okay, and if you virtualize, you can sort of, one way of virtualizing is to say we do it by VLAN, right? So basically this experimenter gets VLAN 1, this experimenter gets VLAN 2, this experimenter gets VLAN 3, and VLAN 4 is used by the normal HP software. But you can actually do it in a more subtle way. We can basically do it by any kind of pattern in the packet. So one example, we're currently preparing a demo for Sitcom, you know, where we have different people doing different things, you know, where I can, for example, say, here I have a certain IP block which gets controlled by this controller, and then here I have a certain set of MAC addresses that gets controlled by this controller, and here I have a certain, a new IP protocol which gets controlled by this controller. So we can virtualize a network not only by VLAN, but using other metrics as well. That's sort of, just as a general background, the kind of substrate we're using, and the problem we're trying to solve for opt-in is basically, with this kind of substrate, how do we connect end users to it? Actually, I'll skip this real quick. So currently we have still four switches running the software, which is basically just a little test deployment in our lab. We're about to expand to 23 switches in the Gates building, so this basically takes over one building. At that point, we'll have a fair number of ports. We probably have in the order of 1,000 ports or so that we can manage. You know, we're hoping north of 100 users, but it's probably still less than 1,000. And phase three, we're taking over multiple buildings, and at that point, we hope to hit, north of 1,000 potential opt-in users, or probably several thousand. I'm actually not sure how many people are in those buildings. It's definitely not. So, if a low number of 1,000 potential users we could opt in on these experiments if we wanted to. So that is as a quick background. And so, one thing to maybe stress here once more. So the network. We're doing this experiments on is the production network at Stanford. So we don't have a separate production network and Genie experimental network. This is the same hardware, the same switch. It's just different software that manages the packets. So now the question is, how do we opt in users on this network? So the First of all, question is, who do we target for opt-in? So when we talk about opt-in, we primarily mean we want to opt in those 1,000-plus users that are basically more or less directly connected to those switches via patch panels that are working at Stanford. Of those users, we generally don't assume they're technical. I mean, many of them are, right? The networking research group is fairly technical when it comes to networks, but, you know, some of them are admins. If you would tell them, you know, reconfigure UPC the following way or, you know, install, you know, set up a tunnel, it's something which we, in many cases, just wouldn't happen. We assume there might be cases where there's lockdown PCs and they can't install software. So basically installing any kind of software on them is probably something that's not going to happen. So also we have probably about any operating system in existence, including some, you know, written by the people themselves running there, so that doesn't scale. We assume constrained devices, right? We want to have people use their cell phone and opt that in into the wireless network. Users may want to opt into multiple experiments at once, right? So different classes of traffic from one user should potentially go on different slices that run concurrently. In addition to users, we're also thinking of local servers. There's Planet Lab nodes at Stanford. There are also production servers that we want to make part of this. And then finally, we have access points, and we're not quite sure yet how to deal with them. If we're going to opt in individual users on an access point, or the way we currently do, you just have a different SSID, and if you go to the access point with that SSID, all your traffic goes over the OpenFlow network. So that's we're not sure what we're going to do there long term, because Stanford has a very good Wi-Fi infrastructure. We like to leverage it. But if you do so, it makes things harder. One thing we're not focusing is basically opting in people that come in remotely. And the reason is that, I mean, for me personally, I need about 10 hops that are 10 routed hops, so 10 hops I can see with traceroute between my home and Stanford. If I would, and probably the reality is probably it's more like 20 or something like that if you count all the switches on the way that don't leave any that basically are not visible in IP. So if in many cases the experiments we're looking at Stanford are sort of experiments in a local area network. If you have if the majority of your hops and the majority of the time that a packet spends is outside of the experimental network that you control, it's not immediately clear, at least to me, how relevant that experiment is at the end of the day. So that sort of provides a rationale for going. Well, that's true, but we're looking at purely the experiments that basically allow you to use different network topology, different protocols, and so on, right? And it's maybe there. I mean, I'm sure there are some, right? I don't want to rule this out. It just looks the majority of use cases we looked at, we've heard from people, right? There, it doesn't really seem to lend itself naturally, at least. I mean, I don't want to say don't do this. My point is just that where we say demand at the moment, this doesn't seem to be the sweet spot. So user experience. I mean, the core hypothesis here is that getting a user to opt into your experiment is hard, right? Initially, who on earth in their right mind would suddenly take part of their traffic and run this on an experimental network controlled by some researcher that, you know, probably doesn't have a clear SLA, that, you know, is probably buggy and unstable. I mean, I'm running over our own little sample deployment, and, you know, the quality has definitely not gone up. It's not much worse, you know, which is good, but it's definitely not gone up. Yes?
Can you say something about your relationship with your IRB?
Our?
Institutional review board?
Did I?
Answer the question.
Sorry?
Answer the question.
Yes.
So I'm not aware of an IRB. Yes. So we have a.
Yeah. Involved in experiments, and clearly you're not using them as a resource in circle.
There are for certain types of experiments. I mean, Stanford had the prison experiment, right? Which so they're quite sensitive to that. If you're doing network. If you're doing network-related experiments, you actually have a fair amount of leeway. We haven't gotten pushback from them yet. You know, it doesn't mean it's not going to happen at some point. But
the other strategy to use is to make sure that the IRB has got people who understand network and actually use the IRB as an ally rather than something to gain.
But do they care about simply having users play with applications? If so, then the vast majority.
I've in the past done measurements, for example, in the Stanford network, where we looked at traffic, and for the scope that I did, we didn't have to involve them.
Well, one of the things that has happened is 15 years ago, the internet was an experiment, and if you used it, you got it up, you know,
That's fair enough. That's fair. I think the approach we're taking is we first need to figure out how to build this thing, right? And then we can figure out the legal structures and all the things on top of it.
For what it's worth, I've just gone through a collaborative effort with Johns Hopkins and their IRB.
We're not going to run medical information over this.
No. This was a
Oh, okay.
So very, very different. We're very concerned about the interaction with human experimenters, especially, or human subjects, rather, especially if there was a possibility of denial of service in new applications that were coming in.
That's fair enough, yeah. No. No, fair enough. And I'm not saying there's no issue there. I'm just saying so far, you know, on our stack priority list of problems that we need to solve in order to make this happen, it's pretty far down. So the in terms of what we think what the user experience has to be like, so the there really is no good reason why a user should opt to experiment, right? In all likelihood, it will lower the quality of the network service that they're going to get. And, you know, this is not a statement about that I'm trying to make experimenters look bad. This is just an experiment of you know, having run experiments myself. If I build a network, it's not as stable as if HP plus the Stanford sysadmins build a network. So we're relying on goodwill here, right? We might try to bribe them by promising an iPod or something like that. But at the end of the day, we want to make it as easy for them as possible to opt in, right? Any additional click that somebody has to do, any additional step that they have to do, will lower the numbers of people, the number of people that we get at the end of the day. So clicks are bad. Right? So the current workflow we think we can implement is that basically user gets an email, you know, that says, you know, we have a new experiment at Stanford, you know, please opt into the new, this case, Coral Plus content delivery network. You know, and you have a chance to win an iPod or something like that. User clicks on email, gets taken to the local opt-in manager at Stanford. User clicks on opt-in, and that's it. At that point, all the traffic that pertains to this experiment of the user goes via the experimental slice of the network. Mm-hmm. Oh, and one more thing is we're not quite sure yet. We're thinking we may need authentication, so they have the user actually authenticate. So we can get an audit trail of who opted in what, just to prevent people from sort of doing abusive opt-ins. Yes?
Do you have a way of distinguishing between shared machines and individual?
That's a great question. No, and that's one of my open questions at the end. So give me a few more slides. So how do we actually technically implement that? And that's sort of our biggest challenge at the moment. And a big disclaimer, this is not fully up and running here yet. This is sort of, at this point, PowerPoint where with a little bit of implementation. So we have the basic network virtualization in place. The actual opt-in mechanism is not working yet. So basically, if I'm a user, by default, I'll be on the production network that we have deployed at Stanford, meaning the part... What actually forwards my packets is the production software from HP running on the HP switch. Right? If I click on that link and say I want to opt in into the Coral Plus content delivery network, at that point my VLAN is moved to a different VLAN, which may or may not be bridged with my original VLAN. We're not quite sure about that. But so for the purpose of the internal topology, to a different VLAN, which is switched by OpenFlow. And initially, this network is also fully switched by an OpenFlow controller that basically is run by the system administrators. So we're still running stuff on the production network. This is now the production OpenFlow network. However, this goes through a flow visor, and now basically we can program the flow visor to split a certain percentage, like to split some of the traffic of the user, which is the traffic that is relevant for this experiment, onto the slice of the OpenFlow network that basically is controlled by the experimenter. I'm not sure if it's from my speed run through of OpenFlow immediately clear that this works technically, but you know, just believe me for a second that it does. I tried to sort of do a little diagram here. So basically how it works is this would be a switch, right? So we have 24 of these running in the building. We have a couple of users here. By default, all your packets would get forwarded by the normal processing path in the switch. If you opt into any Genie experiment, you would get switched to the OpenFlow network. If you're controlled by the OpenFlow part of the network, in that case, any arriving packet would get forwarded to the flow visor, and the flow visor will then make a decision. If this is part of one of the experiments that you opted in, then it goes to the relevant experiment controller, which would be run by the researchers conducting experiments on top of Genie. If this packet is not part of an experiment, then it would get forwarded by the production controller that's run by the system administrators. Does this make sense to everybody at a high level? So the The thing that we need in order to make this happen is basically something called an opt-in manager, which I haven't seen that in any of the Genie sort of architectural diagrams. I mean, the sort of how actually opt-in works in practice seems to be a little bit outside of the scope of those. So our current thinking is that basically this is a server that has to run in the local substrate. Right? Typically, the server will need the cooperation of the local system administrators, so you can't sort of have it somewhere in the cloud. It'll also often need layer 2 access to the network in order to identify MAC addresses or in order to identify ports on switches. And it should pretty much be under the control of the local system administrators. It should not be under the control of the people running the Genie network, because it basically when it comes to who can get opted in, who cannot get opted in, that's something our system administrators want to control and not something that they would necessarily trust us with. What the opt-in manager does is basically provides information to the user about what experiments they are and what they're about. And if a user opts in, it basically then goes, switches them over to the right VLAN, and then programs the flow visor, so this virtualization proxy, to route traffic from that user, to route control over traffic from that user to the right controller. So open questions. We still have a number of things that we're grappling with. I mean, one is, what happens if there's two experimenters that want to have the same class of traffic? So if I want all the port 80 and Jad wants all the port 80 traffic in Stanford, not sure that we even give that to somebody, but let's assume this is the case. And now we have one link. Can this link be shared? I mean, do we have enough visibility into the network that can busy at a per flow basis and say this flow goes to Jad, this flow goes to Guido, or do we just have to say, well, port 80 can only be reserved once, or at least port 80 on a certain VLAN can only be reserved once, otherwise we can't split it up. There's the question of what happens if two users have opted into competing experiments and then try to communicate with each other, right? If saying all my IP traffic should go to experimenter A and Jad says all my IP traffic should go to experimenter B, now we start sending IP between each other. It's not clear which experimenter should get this traffic at the end of the day. Another question we have is if and that was sort of to your question before, if a user says, I want to opt in, what does I exactly mean? Is it the user's MAC address? Is it the user's physical port? Is the user's IP address? Is it a mix of all of those? Can the user select, right? Will the user understand the selection? The answer may be that with the current switching hardware that we have, we might only be able to do MAC. So you might just, what you need for this is basically switching hosts dynamically on different VLANs based on something. And while MAC-based sort of combination of MAC and a radio server, it's still fairly possible to put people on VLANs. It's much harder with IP or port. Yes?
How do you make this understandable to the person who's opting in? I mean,
you don't.
They understand an application. So if you say, this application is going to be using...
So the problem is, let's take the use case, right, of somebody's writing IPv7 and wants to try it out. So all your IPv7 traffic should go somewhere. There is no application, right? I mean, we think the interesting opt-in scenarios here are typically not something which you could define by port or something like that, but it's really something that happens at lower layers. Yes?
There is a lot of overlap between all the things we've been discussing in this, right? You're talking about either users opting into a service in a few cases, or somehow their traffic is being pulled into the network.
I'm talking always about traffic.
Well, but it could be a service, right? You could say to them, well, you do this, and oh, by the way, everything else will work. You're sort of normal, but you get access to this new service.
Can you give an example of such a service?
So, you have curl on your slot, isn't that an example?
Well, the way we'd implement this is curl would get its own IP block, and then all the traffic to that IP block would get routed by the curl infrastructure.
But that's certainly not the only way.
There are potentially other ways, right?
I'm sorry?
Yes.
Well, maybe you could configure an HTTP box. Outside the open flow, I don't
know. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's possible, yeah.
So there wasn't really Genie.
Actually, hold on. To go back to that, I mean, asking users to configure HTTP proxies, actually, and that will be much, much harder. And yes, your chance of getting, say, an iPhone user to reconfigure HTTP proxies, I don't even know. I think it's possible, but the average person would probably have to figure out how.
Are you assuming that the user is a person and doesn't matter?
I'm sorry,
Are you assuming that the user is human and doesn't matter?
So it's often, for the web-based opt-in, yes, right? If you if you basically have the, for if you want to opt in, for example, an access point, you know, that that basically appears as an external network, right, essentially, where there's a bunch of MAC addresses, a bunch of IP addresses outside, that you'd have to opt in a different, with a different mechanism than sort of the web-based mechanism. I mean, that's something we'd have to go to the system administrator and say, can you opt this in? He'd say, sure, edits a config entry, and it works. Yes? Hey.
Okay. Early on, there was a Genie opt-in workshop that had to do with getting people to opt in. Why would they want to do it?
Right.
And the bottom line is, give them a good service, like video or something. So if you gave them the good service, and oh, by the way, examine the traffic, the regular traffic as well as that service traffic, that might be a way to get people in. That's one point. The second point is, yes, this matches one of the other things, which is a sort of, it's not exactly the internet, it's a custom GD network. That's. And third, people are making a choice here, and one of the things we've heard legally is that if people make a choice, they have to have an informed choice.
Yeah, I think that's right.
How you make it informed is difficult. Another thing, right about service. If their service declines a lot.
So to your previous point of, you know, provide a good service and people will be happy. I mean, the...
No, that isn't what... If you provide a good service, you will attract people.
Right. The challenge there is, I mean, you know, maybe this is different for you know, group to group, but I mean, for us, it's been really, really difficult to even get two nines of reliability on our experimental network, right? I mean, if you have a student running a controller, right, versus you have a student running a homebrew controller versus an IT team running a commercial controller, it seems kind of hard to imagine that, you know, unless you do something that's just amazingly better, right, an order of magnitude better, that you can come up to the same level. So, I mean, I think, you know, I hope this will change in the future, but just our experience so far is that these services are worse than the real-world services. Absolutely, yes. So is it opt-in and opt-out? Right.
Finally, the one legal thing that you can definitely be sure of, because we've got whole documents, is privacy, okay?
Yes.
So if people opt in and you somehow know who they are and you start examining their traffic, there are huge privacy issues. So there are legal issues. And
absolutely. If you opt your traffic into an experiment, right, we have no way whatsoever protecting the privacy of that traffic. No, I completely understand, right? It's just that we know for a fact we couldn't possibly anonymize the traffic sufficiently, you know, so we could hide identities. It's.
Brandon, I think you point out somewhat of a division, which I don't think we've made as clearly before, namely, you're opting in by nature of your network.
Oh, the slides. Do you have Keynote? Does it work? Should I just? Oh, actually, you can. Yes.
One of the things that I think is an interesting separation is that your users are the same university, right, by definition.
Yes.
So, which has advantages in the sense that they're governed by some certain amount of trust.
Yeah.
They
have
recourse within the university if an administrator feels like somebody has been reading their email messages and posting them on the website. You might have some reasonable assurance that whichever graduate student will have enjoyed the longest time of his tenure at Stanford. That simplifies a lot of the legal things.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily true for some of the opt-in cases that we've been discussing, which is the privacy issues that Harry's
absolutely,
been talking
yeah.
about, where I'm not sure I trust all of my graduate students to be sufficiently mature not to take a sneak peek at traffic that's coming by and doing things that I'm not comfortable with.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I think our approach at the moment is to say, you know, before we really know what our capabilities are, what we can do technically, you know, what our challenges are, so at that point, you know, starting with the legal and then designing the system afterwards seems backwards in a sense, right?
We're not suggesting that, but we are suggesting that there are things we do know about now, so that may help you. That's all we know.
Okay.
And help you avoid problems and so on. But it's a classic set of the opt-in stuff that you're talking about. It's one from column, you know, that's all it is.
think I need that.
Oh, okay.
Are we actually recording?
No.
Reportedly.
No. All right. Fine.
So we have deployed Seattle.
So we are running Seattle on Jupini. Well, I actually don't have a lot of experience to share. I mean, Justin asked me to say what process I went through to decide to run it, and the answer was really not much. I did ask what implications that had because something would be run. So Jupini is one of the regional optical networks. We've got node clusters at the University of Kansas, Kansas State, University of Missouri, Kansas City, University of Nebraska, and now Lancaster University in the UK, and shortly ETA Zurich with some other expansion going on. So I didn't think a whole lot once he convinced me that it didn't sound like a lot of dire things were going to happen. And frankly, one of the motivations is for us to run stuff. And actually, technically, I think that means we've met our year one milestone, which is to run users on Jupini simply by installing Seattle. Thank you very much. Now, but that did get me thinking a little bit about the sorts of things I would worry about in general. So I thought and I think I've said much of that already, but I just scribbled them down. So for us, we are infrastructure that is supposed to do things like run experiments that we need as well as experiments that are useful to the Genie community. And we're programmable, ultimately we'll be programmable from layer one optical light paths all the way up to layer 7. So opt-in for me is completely orthogonal to the thing I saw put up first, which was why I was raising that. So I put down, I guess, 5 different ways people could opt-in. We will at some point have a set of instructions on what you can do for $2,000 to be a Jupini node, which is you have 5 PCs, you have a particular VLAN switch, and you do this to IP tunnel in, or you do that to layer 2 TP tunnel in. So that is a type of opt-in, and I would worry a little bit about perhaps some renegade node cluster coming in and doing bad things to us. Another opt-in is new aggregates. So we are currently running the Genie wrapper version of Planet Lab. We are running Vini. We will be running DCN. We will somehow try and stitch them together. In theory, since we're just a bunch of processors, somebody could run something else, perhaps Proto-Genie. So that is something I would be concerned about if it was something I didn't trust.
There's a danger here that I want to make sure we have had opted a definitional problem from the very beginning, in the sense that some people had a very expansive notion and some people had a very narrow notion.
Right.
What you describe, at least some people have described, really, there's no bright line boundary, like you try, namely between the notion of federation and the notion of optic, namely that you could, what I'd always taken within this scope, for working purposes within this group, is that if you have researchers contributing resources, and researchers of various stripes, that is closer to the federation end, that's why we call it user optic, as opposed to opt-in in general. This is not...
Right. So actually, Federation wasn't on my list, and that's different from all of those.
What I want to focus, because otherwise we'll never get anything done.
I understand that, but I guess what I'm saying is, let me go through the list then. It's not that long. So another one is running experiments on it.
Again, out of scope from my perspective.
Applications, such as Seattle... And then finally, users running on top of experiments or applications. But I guess what I'm saying is I don't see how you can make that distinction, because I think all of the issues we talk about are completely orthogonal. I don't know whether it's a user by your definition or somebody running an experiment. I'm worried about the same things, trust, policy.
There's a difference, but the crucial difference is as to who is being protected. Namely, the ones that we are worried about are that the user is being protected against possibly either intentional or accidental negative consequences of being part of Genie.
Okay, so this is not at all about protecting the people running the infrastructure.
No, only indirectly, in the sense that by protecting them against bad behavior,
they don't have all, we want to minimize the number of, my grad student did something stupid, and now I have lawyers standing in my office.
Right.
And I have to worry about whether I can ever run another Gini experiment.
Right.
So that's a slightly indirect protection.
One thing to add though, but from the standpoint of the Million Node Gini project, the user is the person who owns the machine. And so in that case, you consider them to be the infrastructure provider, which you were an excellent case of a infrastructure provider, a user, albeit one from a research standpoint, who had hesitation about using our platform initially, which is one of the reasons why.
Right. So actually, you're twisting around and saying, depending on whether you're looking down on the line or up to the line, the user is either side.
Well, I'm saying that I think from the standpoint of this group, the primary things that, at least from our project, that we would consider to be end users are the people who run our platform.
Ah.
The end user, the actual people out on the internet who download and run our software.
I see, okay. Right.
But however, since we were in early stages, we didn't have federation and things like this.
Right.
There wasn't another way for me to get your resources. So in some sense, I was treating you the same as I would have treated someone who happened to have eight nodes with really nice,
I see. Okay.
So we need to move on.
Yeah, that's fine. So, right.
So again, because the level, and this is again one of these, the type of protections that you offer to a grad student who is a network researcher, the kind of worries I have about a somewhat different than I have about my son who finds up on the internet.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure fundamentally why there's that difference, but.
It's shades of gray.
We allow doctors to experiment on themselves without doing without going through IRB.
Yeah.
They don't allow my son to go to a medical experiment without finding out.
Right. Sorry, my display for some reason.
Max never worked on medical.
Well, it normally does. This is actually the first place I've had a problem with it.
Well, they frequently start 10:24. Yeah, I keep going 10:24.
Okay, hold on. That's okay. This should be fine. No, it's right here.
Okay. Hi, I'm Justin Kaplos. I'm here to talk about the Million Node Gini project, also called Seattle, which you guys have already heard a bunch about. Who in here has not seen a demo on this yet? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so about five. Five people. Okay. So what I think I'm going to do, because we are limited on time, is I'm going to kind of blow through the motivation. Everybody can understand why we might want to have a bunch of users all around the world running our code. What I'm going to do is I'm going to quickly show you guys a demo of it and talk through kind of what we have and how we do this.
Sorry, just quickly. By users, you mean just people?
End users, your mom, your grandma, whoever. People on the internet who might be interested in running our software. So we are really looking to get a million nodes by going and getting really anyone and everyone to potentially run our software. And the way that this works from a standpoint is we have to give people something. There has to be some incentive for people to want to go and download this. And so if developers go and they build really nice applications, as a lot of people inside the research community do, they're very effective at getting these downloaded and used in practice. But the point is that we need to have attractive tools for researchers and developers to be able to get them to want to use our software as part of this, as part of the things that they develop. But there's been software at like BitTyrant and other things at the University of Washington that have had well over a million downloads. So we definitely have the potential there. We just need to piggyback what we're doing along with other software that's popular and gets distributed and make this attractive in order to build a large test bed. So I'm going to go ahead and quickly register an account here that I'm going to use to do the rest of this demo, and I'll explain kind of what's happening as I go through this. I need to enter an affiliation, GEC.
So what I'm doing now is I'm essentially going through and registering an account that's going to be able to use the public resources for the MillionNode Genie project. So I'm a researcher just like any other researcher or user in the world. Any person can actually come and do this, any developer. We make this completely open to anyone in the world. Right now, just by going and registering an account, we give them the ability to access and control virtual machines on computers around the world. In fact, we give them the ability to do this on 10 virtual machines. And we incentivize donation of our platform. So right now I could go here and I could download this installer and run a copy of my system, which would be credited to my account. And for every installation I have that adds a node to the testbed, I can access resources on more and more other VMs in the testbed. So the deal is that for every machine that you run your installer on, we give you resources on 10 other machines, which helps our testbed to grow.
I'm sorry. So you didn't go through the motivation, but could you quickly say a couple of sentences why Grandma would want to use this?
Okay. Grandma isn't going to care anything about getting resources on nodes. Developers and researchers are going to care about getting resources on nodes. Grandma's going to care about the software that you as a developer or researcher create, because you're going to create some really nice and interesting applications. That grandma's.
Why would she want to run it on her machine?
Why would grandma want to donate? Well, so you as a developer can provide, for example, better service to users who are able to run this software than you would provide to other people. So grandma right now may be willing to pay a little bit extra to get a bigger pipe, so that she can download her grandkids' pictures a little faster from her internet service provider. So another way that grandma could get better service is by contributing some resources that other people could use, and in exchange she could get better service for this. So it's sort of, if you download Skype, Skype works well and is pretty popular, and it's sort of known that you're going to have this peer-to-peer aspect to it where you're going to be streaming other users' traffic through your system while you use Skype. And people seem relatively happy with that because they're happy with the good call quality and other things that they get with Skype versus other solutions. And so we think that there will be a natural advantage to using our platform as well.
Yeah, but not to be argumentative.
No, that's fine.
So is all that she gets some VMs, or does she get some VMs that are running some service?
Grandma doesn't care about the VMs. All Grandma knows is it's a service. It's an application. And it's Skype. So Grandma has no idea that Skype is streaming things through multiple users. She just knows it works better.
Right, but what she's getting when she goes to this website and downloads Seattle is...
Grandma doesn't come to our website. Grandma downloads Skype, and in the installation for Skype, it says, if you'd like to have a better quality of service with your application, but this will allow us to go and run, third-party code through your system, click yes to opt in.
Yeah. And then there's some API that allows Skype.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I probably shouldn't have skipped all my intro slides, but I was trying to make this faster and may have done the opposite. Okay, so I've gone in and I've chosen to go ahead and acquire a bunch of nodes. So it's gone and it's acquired virtual machines on different computers for me. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to download credentials for this user account that I've created. And I'm going to download a toolkit that's going to allow me to go and access, and it's like a shell that's going to allow me to actually control these resources. It's also going to have a demonstration program in here that I'm going to run. The demonstration program that I'm going to run is just an all pairs ping. It does UDP ping amongst a collection of nodes and returns the latencies between systems. Right, so. I guess I can make that a little bigger. So I'll run an experiment manager here. This is similar to Plush or Gush, or I guess in Planet Lab, the way a lot of people do it is they'll use just SSH to connect to nodes individually. We built a custom shell that allows you to actually go and interact with a bunch of nodes at the same time and do other more convenient things. So, So what I'm doing now is I'm loading and using my credentials. And this is the public key and private key I'm going to use to authenticate myself to the vessels that I have access to the virtual machines that I have access to. And now I've told the shell to go out and locate virtual machines that I should be able to access, and it's gone and it's found the 10 of them that I requested. So now I'm going to perform operations on groups of machines rather than doing it individually. And this all pairs ping expects to have a file that has a name neighbor iplist.txt, and it expects it uses this to know which nodes to send ping messages or UDP ping packets to. So I'm going to upload that. Oh, sorry. Okay, and now I'm going to actually go and just run the program. And I've been given a port number that's consistent across my systems. There's resource controls here that make sure that the resources that are consumed are safe, so that you can run this on your laptop. It's not going the programs that run on here, this all pairs ping program I run, even if it has a bug, even if it's malicious, it can't attack my system and write a virus on there. It can't use up too many resources. If it goes into an infinite loop and things like that, it's all resource controlled. This all runs within a process very much like something like the JVM or something like that, only it's actually a subset of Python.
So can't is a rather strong statement.
Assuming our implementation is correct, then it's perfectly safe from the standpoint of your system to run locally on your computer in terms of resource isolation and also restrictions in terms of, like, it can't go and overwrite files or read files of yours in certain places and things like this. It's basically isolated to only see one directory of your file system. It can send network traffic. It can access memory and CPU and things like this. But all the resources it consumes are isolated. They're all controlled. There's all a very small fixed amount of resources it can consume. So you see I've gone and on a bunch of machines all around the world, I have gone and deployed this code. They're sending ping messages to each other. You can see that one of the systems hasn't sent many ping messages yet. If I refresh this, you'll notice that the values change because this is constantly being updated, displaying this web page. So it was relatively easy for me to go and deploy this code on a bunch of users who have decided to run our software. And any developer can go and very easily do the same thing. So now let me dive back in. Do we have any questions about what it is and how it works? It's basically like Planet Lab at home. It's a little thing you run that researchers can run, Planet Lab-esque code and things like that, on an end user's machine without impacting their security performance or other things. It's a lot like a botnet, but this is being recorded. It is nothing like a botnet. I don't know where you got that from. No more discussion of the sort.
The first rule of botnets, you cannot call it botnets.
Yes, yes, yes. I don't. It's a safe botnet, and to be honest. To be honest, if someone were wanting to write a botnet that they were going to farm out and sell things on, because actually people are renting out botnets now, and this is a sort of an ideal toolkit for them. So maybe we'll get a lot of adoption through the botnet community. Anyway, sorry, but hopefully not. Sorry.
Okay. So if I think of the Seattle experiment as the thing, right? In effect, you've got two classes of users. You've got users that are contributing resources, right?
Yes.
Yes. Similar people, but well, maybe the same people, but
they're often not the same people in our system. Yeah. Well, I really see the people who are consuming the resources, at least if you're talking about the point of the people who are writing the code, and like if you're counting me as consuming resources because I just went and ran this code, I'm very much like a developer then. I'm very much like a researcher. In that sense of it, it's I'm a person who is like the grad student who's going and building an application that they want to test out and deploy in different scenarios.
You got access because you contributed resources, right?
That's true, but anyone can contribute resources to our system, and anyone can get resources on public systems. We have all kinds of people who have no idea who they are.
So that was my point.
Yes. Yes. And we definitely try, we're not trying to restrict the people who can go and download our installer, run it, register accounts, and use things. People can even set up their own private versions of this. If you don't want to be part of like this public collection, if you just want a bunch of machines that can run your own Seattle code on them, you can set up your own private version of the test bed and then only allow user accounts you want to have allowed or do things like that. So let me go ahead and push on. So we've had use in really from three user groups, and I'm going to talk briefly about all of them. We've actually had a lot of instructors use this in classes. So if anyone here teaches a networking class, we'd really love to have you guys use it. We've already had this used. The project's only 9 months old. We've had it used in 6 networking classes already, and this is before we gave a talk. Or I gave a talk at SIG CSE about this. So we've had a tremendous amount of interest in this, and the reason why is because instructors who teach networking classes, they are typically give assignments on LAN, and they tell the students, this is what networking's all about. You know, send from computer A in the lab to computer B in the lab. And it looks nothing like the real internet. And so we can provide students with a much more realistic experience. It's extremely easy to get up and going with this. Most of the researchers, in fact, almost all the researchers who work on the project are undergraduates, many of which have never taken a networking class. So I have, you know, we've had tremendous experience with getting people with very limited backgrounds to use this, and it's been very, very, very productive. And we have tremendous resources for educators, too, a bunch of example assignments, and we even have community support where there's different workshops that are being hosted at major conferences related to this. Yes?
So it provides an excellent environment for distributed system research, but or teaching. Yeah. But I'm not sure for low-level network teaching that's the right tool unless you are able to expose some limited set of interfaces and say, well, this node has 4 interfaces now, and it connects directly to this other node. So is that possible?
So right now, the current scope of the project, the current scope of the implementation of the project is we're not worried about network devices. At the highest level, we're not particularly worried about network devices with multiple interfaces. We're viewing things much more from an end host perspective. So, but you can do things where you control the middle of the network, and Jen has actually built an auto grader for us where it'll go and it will... because you don't want to grade student assignments on the internet because you'll get different answers every time. The students won't like you for that. If every time you grade their homework, you get a different answer. So instead what we do is we go and we deploy an EmuLab topology that has all the sorts of resources that we want and all the link characteristics and everything else. We deploy the student code on there. We run it along with a testing suite. Then we go and we pull the information back from this, and we grade the results automatically for the instructor. Just they just click a button, and they don't know any of this has happened. So we do actually have ways of doing things like that will allow you to also control lower levels of the network. Yep, I'll wrap up real quick. We have two other quick use cases. We have developers who are using this. We're starting to move into this. We've had educational use, what I'd consider production quality educational use, but we haven't yet had this for developers or researchers. We're just starting to move into this now. We've got a lot of great advantages to this, and I'll put the slides online so you can read more about this later. And for researchers, there's obviously a lot of reasons why one might want to use this as opposed to EmuLab or things like that. And the real question we have now, we'd love to have people use it, and we want to know what sort of things that you want to do, you would like to do with our system. What would you like to do if you had a million nodes that have real mobility patterns, if you had this running on people's laptops all around the world, if you had nodes behind NATs and firewalls and things like this, and you could have real users and real user patterns, how would this help your research? What would you like to do? Oh, you can run software on the node that collects whatever data you want. You can write your own code that does that sort of instrumentation. It'll persist as the node moves, potentially. Okay, and currently you can see that we have quite a mix of nodes. From looking at what has contacted our system, we have a relatively large number, roughly half of the unique IPs that have contacted us have been from home users and things like that. We do have a significant number of Planet Lab nodes, and also we have a lot of university nodes from instructors who've used this in classes and installed this on their machines.
So are
Pretty much, yeah. We pretty much all by default. Yeah. Okay, and so this is my summary slide. I think I've already gone over this. Existing testbeds don't model the internet. We've built a testbed using the public internet, and we have users in education, research, and development. So hopefully this gives you an idea of how things go. So any questions in the 10 seconds?
So. Particularly since we got started late, I have to move through this very quickly. So I'm going to introduce it. And this is the other document which I alluded to that I really would like people's comments on and get people to help review. As we said, we got into the opt-in overview, and we decided that the structure issues were important. And we had to define Gini entities and actors, aggregates that provide resources, for example, management authorities that are responsible, and then delegate things, aggregate administrators, operators, and so on. And now we can say the management authority can enter into agreements for the aggregate. So who in the world is the management authority? If an aggregate is often provided by a research institution, by Columbia, University of Washington, and a research group at that university, then that research group, in effect, becomes the management authority, perhaps in combination with other university officials or groups. The trustees of are probably the ultimate authority. Same kind of thing on the slice side. You have slices that are abstract entities that contain resources. You have a slice authority that's responsible for things. They delegate things to administrators, PIs, researchers. Again, the slice authority can enter into agreements, and the slice what is almost always utilized by researchers at a research institution. And again, that group, that institution, becomes the slice authority. You're going to require agreements on resource usage, cooperative operations, and absolutely on acceptable use agreements and best practices. How in the world would you structure this? If I have a bunch of research organizations, all of which have management authorities and slice authorities, you could conceivably write a mesh of agreements between 20 different organizations. That is not practical, not scalable. So the obvious simple answer is a two-level hierarchy, which we show here, where you define a Gini suite authority, you have research organizations, and so forth. This is exactly the structure that Planet Lab uses, and this is exactly the structure that has often been assumed as the basis for Gini, but people haven't talked about it and explained it. You are also going to have structures where you have federated things like this, right? Gini in the U.S. is going to talk to the European organization and federate. Now you're going to have agreements between the master organizations and sub-agreements. These are legal things. Okay. When we but we're also going to, I think, have more complicated things. I think that very easily in Gini there are going to be local groups of universities that bind themselves together. All of the wireless test beds, regional things. So you're going to have regional local suites that somehow get federated into bigger suites. All of these things are going to happen in the Gini world. We've discovered a variety of other projects out there that also have structures. Typically, they're this two-level structure with a hierarchy, but some have slight variations on that. So some of them are listed here. And I think the Genie world has to study this and look at the things and look at the agreements that are written. There's probably hundreds of pages of agreements to study. If we assume a two-level hierarchical structure, we say it's like Planet Lab. Actually, this diagram and in the document is a much more detailed view of what that means in Planet Lab. Planet Lab has a central Planet Lab consortium. There's a steering committee. There are policies. There's an ops group. There's a Planet Lab central with a slice registry. There's physical things, entities, people, and so forth. Within various research organizations, there are resources that are put out. Oh, nodes in the test bed that are typically run by they may or may not be run by researchers. They may be run by the operations group of that test bed. There may be networking resources that's run by the local CIO, research groups that have tools and so forth that are, in effect, run by PIs. So you have a complicated web of entities and actors in here, but the same basic structure is there. What we came up with in the April meeting, in the Genie world, if you start adding some of the other things you need, is a structure with actors like this. It's much... So we have a Genie suite, we have some sort of governance policies, an ops group, a clearinghouse with registries. Looks like Planet Lab. We suggested that there would be an experiment review board, both locally and maybe at the Genie level, to help people decide good experiment, bad experiment. And from time to time, you may have to involve institutional review boards if this stuff goes towards the human subjects. This is the kind of detailed structure that we think is going to have to be thought about in the Genie world. Lots of agreements, lots of actors, and you have to begin to say, if this happens, these things happen, and so forth. And, oh, by the way, all this has to be captured in membership agreements that people sign up to up front. It is not obvious how the Genie world starts. It is not obvious how the Genie world ends, right? Today, the Genie world is starting where the GPO is sort of in that Genie suite space, but not officially. And the projects are sort of the research organizations. But it's going to evolve over time. Okay. The next steps are to review this document and to figure out how to fill things in. And we think it's going to affect all the rest of the Genie architecture, because if you say, I can have a nice, rich structure, I have to be able to support that in the rest of Genie. And if you begin to look at the detailed stuff, which is what Henning's going to cover next in terms of best practices, all of that feeds into those agreements. Any questions? Let's leave people, I don't know, late in the day.
Struggles, or one of the discussions that we had repeatedly. Up Genie beyond what we've done in Planet Lab. Another thing is to make it easy for experimenters to run experiments at fairly large scales in terms of user population and just the number of diversity of experiments. If we look at Planet Lab, yes, there are a number of experiments that have large number of users, but that number is relatively small. It's just we always cite the same coral type experiments, and that's well, there's a dramatic drop off from a million one to the 10 node one. So the discussions that we've had in the meeting at Columbia, as well as just private discussions along the way, are what can we do to facilitate that by coming up with a set of questions and infrastructure that let me just go. Da, da, da. Okay. We've had those. To do basically a common set of policies and that might actually have a problem that our speaker from Europe had this morning. Okay.
That looks slightly better.
Is that why you're raising your hand? Thank you. That you have four more cases, probably a few more subcases that we need to deal with. So what we need are essentially four things for this type of thing. We need to have governance, what Harry was talking about, policies which describe kind of must-do things, best practices which describe should-do things, and operations which we've often labeled as the red button, namely if one of the things that either a policy violation is in progress or the best practices were insufficient to prevent harm, there needs to be a way to abort experiments, particularly when, let's say, use case 4 occurs, namely that a third party is affected by that, and we can't wait until the graduate student comes back from vacation to deal with that. I'm primarily going to discuss some of the issues related to the middle part. Harry talked a little bit about the first part in this. So, one way to look at this is that we have, for opt-in, namely the ability of users to decide whether they want to participate, either as a provider of resources or as the user of an experimental infrastructure or service, kind of four levels of goodness. I think, generally speaking, we want explicit informed consent. The important word being explicit, in a sense, it's deliberately done by the individual user, and it's informed in a sense the user understands what they're agreeing to, as opposed to just clicking through randomly. We might have an implicit opt-in in some cases. If we visit Google Labs, you don't necessarily go through a lot of reading before you simply download the application or use the service. But there's a privacy statement, for example, or a description on the website that if you have any concerns about the experiment, you can, or about the beta service, you can read it, and hopefully you'll get an idea as to what might happen to your data, for example. A third level, which I think is one which we have not discussed a whole lot, in some cases, this is the case on VLANs and SSID, for example, which is one that we had at SICOM last year, that there was an experimental SSID which had some label on it, and if you used that, your data was being monitored. Your usage of a network was being monitored. So that's what I would consider discoverable, where if you're curious about it, there was a way to find out what it was. You could ask in that particular case, the local registration desk, and they would know who to ask in more detail, or maybe there was some other way, which I'll talk about, to find out what was going on, even though there was no explicit step in 102. And the fourth one, which I think is one which is dangerous, this is why it's in red, where without any of these other things, you are suddenly part of an experiment and you don't know, you have no way of discovering it short of being a network engineer, and it might have negative consequences. So we want harm avoidance. That's pretty clear. We talked about that a lot. And that can be to the users themselves, to researchers. Namely, we don't want their reputation to be damaged by doing bad things, distraction by lawyers, to the hosting institution. If a graduate student does something bad, if it makes the front page of a newspaper, to use that cliche, it won't say random graduate student John Doe did it, but random graduate student Columbia University did it. And we want to prevent harm to Genie overall. We don't want necessarily to be Genie as being seen as Pirate Bay 2.0 or something like that. And this is a long-term viability issue. We talked about this better before, so I won't go through that. We have Genie resources that could be opted in, but it's not just about the things that James talked about, kind of the lower-level things. It could well be higher-level applications, for example. We have a wholesale opt-in. I think this has been discussed to some detail before as to what we should do. I think one of the outcomes of today's discussion is that I think it bears room for a more technical discussion as to, is there a set of common things, kind of common practices such as VLANs and VPNs and IP addresses and ESSID that we should use across experiments if you face a similar model. And for example, is there a way that we can label ESSID in a way that makes opt-in more feasible? Is there a way to use some DHCP techniques to automatically enroll, once you've enrolled your MAC address, into a different subnet, et cetera? Yes. Yes. So that's, I'll mention that actually in a, So, and there's others such as outbound proxies and things like that, which we haven't talked about a lot, but it certainly goes along as well. So what are some of the risks? And Harry talked about that. And one of the things that James mentioned, as we didn't mention, is the legal exposure. So what happens if you inadvertently, because of you're part of an experiment, you inadvertently host child pornography on your system? Not a good thing. Just the issue of having to deal with lawyers to explain as to that you're an innocent host is probably more than most people would want to ever risk for being part of a Genie experiment. It's just not worth the trouble. The other ones we've talked about. So one of the notions that I've been trying to push is some version of what I've seen as has been successful here. This is a riff on a well-known advertising slogan, if you haven't picked that up. There's an experiment for that. And I think one of the reasons that we could learn from that is two things. And the A is that many small applications have gotten exposure, even if you're one of 50,000, that they would never have gotten before, because the only way previously is to put up a web page and hope that somebody Googles it. Now, with the App Store, at least, there's a way of systematically exploring certain types of applications, and you might discover others, just like you browse a bookstore or a library. I think that would be something that I think would be encouraging opt-in behavior that we want. But it also has, to some extent, a standardized disclosure of services and experiments. So you have informed consent. You have, for example, a set of data that might be gathered. I have more on that in a second. So what would be the experimental disclosure? And here, we had this discussion in the hallway. What I would argue that there has been, in general, a whole subfield of behavioral economics in particular. The book Nudge has given that a certain public visibility, that we need to do information presentation in ways that are not just kind of random, but that are designed to achieve certain goals, hopefully beneficent goals. So if you look at, for example, that what we find for credit card disclosures or nutrition labels, or there's a New York Times an article about mortgage labels, that disclose information in ways that are meaningful to users and that are standardized. In the sense that, unlike, say, privacy statements, which typically in these days have 50 pages of mind-numbing legalese, where everybody writes their own privacy statements if they don't copy it from somebody else, and they do it in ways which are meant to obfuscate typically often rather than to illuminate, that's exactly where we don't want to go. And unfortunately, I don't trust my graduate students to write that. I mean, that's not their skill level. They're not lawyers. They're not information designers. So the kind of questions that we can come up with, and I think this would be leading towards an information design like an XML structure or something like that, what kind of experiment it is, some kind of description. Who is responsible for the experiment? So who do you contact if something goes wrong? And this is not just for graduate student, but basically the hierarchy of responsibility. And if you're not satisfied with the response you get from a graduate student, is there an advisor you contact, et cetera. What data is being collected? How long it's retained? Who has access to the data? Is there an effect on other applications? If I run this particular service, will something else suffer when I do that? Will it run more slowly, whatever? important consideration, which I think people don't necessarily understand directly, but better understand, is, for example, if I run this experiment, and this is used as an example of that, suddenly your PC won't be able to go to sleep because it's constantly running services, which means you're implicitly agreeing to $50 more electricity cost each year. People don't realize that, but that's an issue these days. You have to, at least, I think it's honest to tell people that this could be something you worry about. Is there extra traffic involved? Skype has gotten somewhat of a bad name, despite people making that trade-off, and people turn off various things because they suddenly see the light blinking on their modem, and they don't know why, and that worries them for a variety of reasons, particularly once we get into an environment where people pay by bandwidth by the bit. Or is this type of application or service something I should be running on a device which has bandwidth limitations or has battery power limitations? That's something I might need to know. And what might I get in return? Do I get an iPhone? Do I get entered into raffle? Or is it just because I want to provide benefits to humanity? Or do I get better service or whatever the case may be? And there are probably more questions that should be added to that. But that's the kind of level of questions that I think experiments need to think about. Yes?
Sure. Just one 10-second thing. We haven't tested this extensively on every laptop on Earth, but most of us have Macs, and they seem to still go to sleep just fine with Seattle running.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's good.
Yeah.
And some do it.
Okay. We have thought about that.
Yeah.
That's an excellent thing to bring up.
Yeah, because that's a concern to people. And the idea is to have a set of reasonably generic questions that in some cases is just not applicable. In other cases, I think it forces people to at least think about things that may not be obvious if you don't understand exactly how networking works, which most people that we target with is obviously won't. So the other one is for information gathering. I think it is helpful if we, again, make it pretty clear, and this is one attempt to do that, to delineate in ways which are understandable, which is this clearly is not. This is meant to be technical, somewhat technical, to see what levels of information I gather, and so that you can assess the risk value of the information that might be collected about you. Without going through that in detail, kind of at the most dangerous part is where content and content identifiers are gathered, such as your email is being collected somewhere, your download content, all the way to what is probably relatively harmless, where the aggregate flow volume over many users of a certain web traffic is gathered in a university. Probably less of a concern, and there might be ways in between. I'm not claiming this is the best way of dividing it, but the idea is to come up with a set of rough categories so that you don't have to make as a normal user determinations as to whether something which you don't know what it is. How many users know what a MAC address is and know how identifiable it is, that you have some way of assessing whether, for example, this is something where if your content is being read and this is operating in a doctor's office, well, you should figure out that that's probably a bad idea. Regardless of what else you do, that is just not a system that should be part of that experiment. Because the risk of getting in trouble with HIPAA is just too large to be warranting that, and other things along those lines. So I don't think we want to have every experiment describe everything in detail, but give something labeled so that I can know this is relatively risk-free versus you shouldn't do this unless you know that this is a pretty public data. Yes? Yes.
And one of the things that I have a reservation about is whether or not the research themselves can evaluate whether or not they're adequately protected because it's so subtle.
Yes. And I would argue that before
this, how hard it is, it's been shown that for movie length files, the file size itself is almost always huge.
Yes. And my general, and this is part of the best practice and all that, is that I think in many cases, particularly when data from users that are not, that don't necessarily understand, can't really expect it to understand these type of fine points, is that the conservatism that has to be applied in keeping that data for anything but the time it takes to add up some numbers should be extremely, we should be extremely conservative with that. And that's just, if you need more data, well, then maybe you should get an explicit IRB project approval where people can be informed to the level that they know what they're getting themselves into. Third-party impact. So far, the one we've discussed seems to involve primarily probing. It would be interesting, like port scanning, things of that nature. So it would be interesting to narrow that down expand that a little bit. Are there other third-party impacts besides probing and denial-of-service attacks and things of that nature? So one of the things that I think goes a little bit towards what you were hinting at in the beginning is I think we should discuss whether, as part of best practices, are there ways we can make it easier for people that are affected by these experiments, accidentally or otherwise, to find out where this is coming from. So these are just some possible ideas. So should you be running, if you have a Genie host, a miniature web server on that, which basically if you connect to port 80 on that thing, it says, you've reached a Genie experiment host. It is running this experiment, description here, this is the contact people and all of that. Should you put something like that in the DNS records? All of these things to make it easier for people to basically get out of the big skitman, some node is attacking me type of thing mode quickly as opposed to people panicking and calling Columbia network operations who have no clue what my host is doing. I think there are best practices we can recommend that reduce the panic level and the frantic searching for graduate student effect that you get when somebody calls our network operations center, which usually does not end well. Lots of panic ensues for no particularly good reason. And we should have a do not call list of some sort, probably. And this should be certainly for an experiment. I think that's a lot to ask for each host to say, I don't want to be probed, and I have to redo that for each for each experiment. That's as silly as the Canned Spam Act, which assumes that you have to opt out of every single mailing list in the universe individually. So I suspect we want to have a Genie-wide list of, say, I don't want to hear from any experimental host. Thank you very much, and please observe that. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about the IRB one. The problem, which was already mentioned, is that we've discussed this a lot, that current IRBs are necessary and can be helpful, but that they don't happen by themselves because most of them are more medically oriented. They often don't have computer science or network expertise. Their expertise, just because you went through an IRB doesn't mean that the IRB was able to evaluate that this is a way for your host to become bots. That's not their level of expertise in many cases. And they often deal with single institutions, which doesn't work well when you have multi-institution experiments. That's it. So these are kind of things that I'm hoping to flesh out in some of the documents and text with your help. We have minus 49 seconds left, so quick comments, suggestions on that. Does that seem roughly heading in the right direction, or is there a big piece missing that we should add to that on the best practices and policies as opposed to the governance side? Yes. Oh, yeah. One of the things that I didn't get to talk about and I didn't get to put on a slide is one of the things that I'm thinking about for this list is that there may well be for experiments a kind of just like on the ski slopes, you have black diamond and you have bunny slope. As in some experiments are just, and this may be also a maturity quiz. I mean, initially some experiments are just not suitable for non-experts. They're suitable for you and your qualified daughter, but they're not suitable for my son, who's a high school student. And that, I think, is an important part so that we don't measure every experiment with an impossible yardstick, yet we don't foist immature stuff on people that really have no way of evaluating it and just see Genie and say, oh, this must be, I mean, it's the National Science Foundation. Oh, it's the same people who sponsor Sesame Street, so it must be safe. Yes. And
maybe it's the word, somebody was talking about how words are important, but I guess that we could probably slice that one in different types. But I think it's the word end user that maybe.
Yeah, we've tried. I mean, this is something I've sent a comment to Harry as well, as we've used in the document words like innocent user, things like that. I'm not happy with those terms. Yeah, I mean, innocent reminds me of maturity in ways which are more rated along the PGR and C scale, which I think we don't want to get into. Yes. Yes, and so we need a good term. What I think we mean is that there are clearly at least two classes of ones that are in this room, generally speaking, and that have a trained computer scientist or equivalent, and others who may well be moderately savvy computer users but are not networking researchers. And obviously anything left of that, in a sense of... Exactly. But I mean, that's what I said. They are not, they have...
It's the slash dot crowd.
It might be where I think this is, again, I think we know this in other fields. If you look at, again, the medical field, is that if a nurse or a doctor participates in an experiment, you don't worry so much about, they can do, as far as I know, they can administer whatever drug they want to themselves, and they don't have to go through an IRB. And if a nurse... Within limits, but it's very different than if you or I walk into a doctor's office and are part of a medical experiment. And so we need to find a term, that's clearly where I see my view of the opt-in group value is we've done okay in the Planet Lab space primarily with that with our group of users. And we're trying to expand Genie into the slash crowd and the grandma crowd, and that requires additional work, which hasn't really been done to the same extent. And clearly the risks are larger, simply also because suddenly the ability for other users, such as suddenly a botnet operator discovering the opportunities that they can get by leveraging an experiment as goes on, become much larger than they were in the more constrained Planet Lab experiments or similar type of things. Other comments on that? Okay, I think we are done for today. So like Harry said, we need feedback on the documents. Text that you can write, particularly if you have crisp definition of terms. That's usually the biggest problem, is to agree on the words so that we don't have the same discussions again and again. That would be most helpful. And then otherwise, Justin, and we'll see you in wherever we're next in GSE 6. Okay. Anything else, Harry? Oh, there will be a readout tomorrow of this as well.
Slides tomorrow in the plenary session, and I'll prepare them to summarize a little bit of what we said and to bring that structure issue to the break. Anybody has any other suggestions, please let me know. Thank you. Everybody came, and happy to chat more, but we should end.